everybody. This is Paul Bowman coming to you from the secret studios deep in the Ouachita National Forest. I'm here with my co-host, James Waldo.
How you doing, Paul Bowman?
Oh, any better? I think it was a setup. First things first, might as well get right to it. It's been a long time, friends and neighbors, since we've had an episode. We'd like to start off by kind of making an announcement. We've had some personnel changes at the NAWAC. Daryl Collier and Matt Pruitt, along with Mike Mays, they've left the organization and gone on to greener pastures. I'm told that those pastures also have wood apes. So they're not out of the business. They're just out of the organization. We wish them the best. Wish them well. I still have contact with those guys, and I think they're doing great. Wish them well. So,
yeah, I think we both talked to Daryl and Matt in the last few days. So for those of you that don't know me, my name's James Waldo. As Paul said, I've been a member of the NAWAC for a few years now. It turns out the first time I was ever on the podcast, I was a co-host. So it's funny how those things work out sometimes. But we haven't done a show in quite some time, and we thought it was way past high time to correct that. And Paul, I found some interesting information about the show. How many episodes of this show do you think have been recorded previously?
I have no clue. If I had to guess, I'd say 20.
Well, I was surprised. That's actually pretty close guess. I was surprised to know that this is actually episode 16. I thought there were more episodes than this, but there's not.
Well, so that's actually a good segue, because I think that in this world that we live in of content creators and influencers and what have you. I know that podcasting is a big business right now. And ultimately people listen to be entertained. I think to be informed is also a good cause for listening. But I'd like to emphasize that our organization is not about entertainment. You know, we have a mission, and we'd like to inform the public on our activities and what we're doing, and we hope that that's entertaining. But, and I know Matt and I have talked about this in the past with some of his other podcasting adventures, but having to constantly come up with content weekly or monthly to sort of satiate your listenership can be a struggle. And so oftentimes with the NAWAC, things really start to pick up in March, April, May. That's when there's kind of a dormant period, usually over the winter months, where there's just not a lot going on, you know, and so there's not much to talk about. So what we'd like to do, along with this new year, I say new year, we're already almost into the second quarter, but is we're going to focus mainly on a more NAWAC-centric program and try to keep the public informed on any new discoveries or content, if you will, mostly generated from our field excursions. But that's kind of the main focus, I think, of our show. You have anything to add?
Well, yeah, I'll expand on that a little bit. You know, we sort of want to talk about ourselves a little bit, change up the format, maybe not quite as long as it has been in the past. And we don't really want to compete with the other podcasts out there that are sort of in this genre. There's a lot of people that sort of make the circuits on the podcasts, and you know, it's sort of the same show over and over. There's a new book, and you know, everybody talks to them, and we all hear that, and it makes for good content. But we want to talk about our organization and what we do and how we do it, why we do what we do. And I think what we'll end up doing in the next few episodes is sort of recapping the last couple of field seasons. There's been some really good evidence collected in the last couple of years that really nobody has heard about. And I think many people would be interested in hearing that. One of the other things that we wanted to do while we recorded this show, or while we kind of revamped the podcast, was talk to some people in the organization that we had never talked to before, which was actually very surprising to me. But one of those people is Alton Higgins, who's sort of our grand patriarch of the organization. So this episode and the next episode is dedicated to an interview that we recorded with Alton a few months ago now, on location in Eastern Oklahoma, sort of in the general vicinity of Area X, but in a cabin at a Kitchen Table. It was a great interview. Paul and I both heard things from Alton that we had no idea about. We never heard those things. He covered some topics that we've talked about before that we've got information about on the website, like the Concho, Oklahoma Bigfoot sightings. Alton was involved in that, and he'll talk about that in the interview.
And somehow Alton has escaped the microphone, so to speak. I don't know how or why. I know he kind of shies away from it. So he has eluded our previous hosts as far as being interviewed. And we thought it would be a good opportunity to get him into a studio or in front of a mic and let him rip. You know, he has, for those of you who don't know, Alton Higgins, he's kind of our spiritual guru and the great sage of the NAWAC. He's sort of the intellectual baseline, I think. He's a retired field biologist, ornithologist, biology professor. He's had so many experiences in the field with these animals. He's forgotten more about Bigfoot than I'll probably ever learn in my lifetime. He's also a stalwart friend and trusted colleague. He's fearless in the field. I mean, and I count myself amongst this group, but I you know, we've had guys running around with rifles and ghillie suits, and Alton will be in the corner with a pair of binoculars and a can of bear spray, just sitting and standing quietly listening and observing while everyone else is freaking the hell out. It's just, he's fearless and he's got some amazing stories. And we just felt the need to get those stories out for all of those to enjoy. So, and he's also, like I said, he's a dear friend, a wonderful person. And so without his guidance and his leadership in the organization, I don't think we would have made it this far. So this is going to be an exciting episode, I think, to hear some of his stories.
Yeah, certainly. And I know a lot of people have been waiting a while for us to get our stuff together and get this episode out. So, you know, we really wanted to make that happen. So again, this is a two-part episode. We spent about an hour and a half recording with Alton, and it was definitely enough to make it two shows. So we'll release this one, and then this will, the second one will follow not too much longer, a week or so maybe afterwards.
Well, without further ado, let's listen to this interview with Alton Higgins.
Right after this.
So we are sitting down with Chairman Emeritus Alton Higgins. Alton, would you mind telling us a little bit about yourself?
I was going to say I'm not a Chairman Emeritus, just a Director Emeritus.
I stand corrected.
There you go. The Grand Poobah himself.
It works for me.
Yeah.
You're much more than that to us, though. You're sort of our great sage and forever mentor. So.
Well, thank you.
It's the truth.
That's not how I think about myself.
Well,
I feel privileged to be a part of the group that we have here.
Well, I think it goes without saying. I don't want to speak for the organization, but I think it's fair to say that you've been our de facto spiritual and intellectual leader since I've been around, at least. So, and that was 2006. So I think that. That qualifies, sir.
You look a lot younger as the years have gone by.
Well, that's... now I know something's wrong. That,
yeah, now you know the stories I'm going to tell are going to have a tainted sense of reality here.
Well, that's what we love about you. What I've noticed is that you... Every time I'm around you, I hear something new. I hear a story that I have not heard before. For what, 15, 16, 18 years, however long I've known you, that's remarkable. We'd like to hear some of these stories today.
Yeah, we shared some of the stories during our retreat. Yeah, I'd be glad to talk to you about, you know, whatever you want to talk about. Got any ideas where to start?
Well, how about first just telling us a little bit about your background?
Okay, well, I was born and raised in Arizona. My father was a big hunter, fisherman, and he would take us out sometimes. I love the outdoors, and I wanted to work with wildlife. So I graduated from Arizona State University with an undergraduate degree in wildlife biology, and my graduate degree is in zoology. But I worked as a wildlife biologist for several years, censusing birds and doing riparian-type studies in Arizona, where riparian vegetation is, you know, extremely important. As far as getting involved with this kind of research, it goes back to a vacation we took to the Pacific Northwest, where we have relatives, including my favorite cousin, who is a music minister at a pretty large church. And we had our last day visiting with them before we had to come back to Oklahoma. And Lynn decided that we could go spend half the day with the boys. Our sons are the same age. Go spend the morning looking around the country and what have you. And the girls would go when we came back to Portland to do some shopping. So off we went, and we stopped at a meadow where some of the old hunter guys in his church had told him to check out. It was east of Mount St. Helens, so there was ash all over the place. Our sons were playing in a big borrow pit, and we went off to search for sign. He went to the right, I went to the left, and I came across a large scat. It was freshly deposited. It was minced, very finely chewed vegetation. It was green, and it was shaped. It was pretty large, and large animals leave large scat, but I didn't know what it was. We'd had skull and scat labs in our biology classes, in our wildlife classes. I just didn't know what it was. Curly Q, ice cream coney kind of look to it. Well, as I was puzzling over it, I saw another one, and I went over to look at it, and it was the same. It was very, very fresh, nothing but finely chewed green vegetation. And then I know this sounds very strange, but the cover there was very kind of scattered, and I saw another one of these scats, all three about the equidistance apart and in a line. So it was very curious to me. I'm looking at the third one, and then I noticed a very large footprint next to it, just like the animal had squatted down. So I started yelling for my cousin, waving my arms. He didn't hear me, but he said he saw me. He rushed over because he could see I was excited about something. And I'm pointing at the scat, and even before he came to a stop, he said, "I don't know what that is." And then I pointed next to it at that track, and he squatted down and just stared at it for the longest time and finally looked up at me while he was still, you know, squatted down, and he just shook his head yes. He knew what it was. So we collected one of them and took it back, and I could not stop thinking about this. We put it in his freezer, you know, for maybe future analysis or something. Couldn't get it off my mind, though. Just before we left on this vacation, we got our first computer, and I did my first search when we got back. I think I just typed in Bigfoot, and I got this massive line of hits. So I started down through them and pretty quickly became discouraged because so many of the websites were terrible looking and misspelled words and incomplete sentences and that sort of thing. And I finally came to the BFRO's website. It looked at least halfway decent, and there weren't any misspelled words. So I saw that there was a place to submit a report. It looked the most decent of all the sites that I'd looked at. And so when I saw the submit report thing, and it looked like they were kind of a scientific group, I submitted a report about what I'd found. And I thought, well, at least I'd done something. Well, to my shock, the next morning at work, Mid-America Christian University, I got a phone call from some guy from the BFRO. And he said they're very interested in the report, and so they wanted to know if I'd go out and show them where it was. And I said, "I'm in Oklahoma. You need to get with my cousin. He lives out there." So they did go out there, I learned later, and they found that the track was just part of a trackway. But like I said, I couldn't stop thinking about it. Eventually, Matt Moneymaker contacted me and said, "We've got a report from close to where you live. Wondered if you could check it out." So I did, and reported back to him that I thought it was misidentified owl calls. And to my surprise, he said, "Thanks, great, thank you." Because I was thinking he'd be disappointed that I didn't come back at him with, "Yeah, that's a definite Bigfoot activity there. So over time, I became more and more involved with them. So for several years, I was an active member of the BFRO, back before the days when they were doing all these expeditions and stuff.
Wow. So Matt Moneymaker just called you up, and it basically recruited you to become an investigator.
Right.
Wow.
Right.
So what year was the year that you were out near Mount St. Helens? Obviously after 1980, because that's when the eruption was.
Mm-hmm. I think it was the late 80s.
Okay.
I'd have to do some searching on that. Probably if I could find my report on the BFRO's website, I could see the exact date. I just don't recall it offhand.
Okay. I was just curious.
Yeah. My son was about 12, so I could eventually figure it out from that. But
okay. You know, coincidentally, making a trip to Mount St. Helens is how I ended up in the career field that I'm in now.
Wow.
Because I'm a geologist. I was stationed up there in the military as a young man, and we went out one weekend to see Mount St. Helens, and I was so impressed by it that it just changed the course of my life. Kind of the same thing. If there's something,
the common thread there.
Common thread about Mount St. Helens.
Well, if you want to, that's actually a good segue to the points that you made this morning about how you got involved in looking into this part of the state as far as reports or, you know, a research area. And I really liked the conversation about how this has been a known animal, a known creature in this region for at least 100 years, if not more. And
right.
There's so much background there.
Yeah, well, my first hint that there might be something going on out here was the Legend of Boggy Creek movie, Terrified Us. We went out to see that movie. And I thought that was just kind of a standalone, you know, monster kind of a thing, not necessarily the same thing as Bigfoot. But when activity started coming to my attention, I started to realize, and of course, through the BFRO website, we started getting reports from out this area, and that's when I first understood that there was the possibility of these kinds of creatures living in this part of the country, as well as the Pacific Northwest.
So what led you to this spot, this area?
Well, we were getting reports, and I eventually decided to come out here to look around myself, and met some folks that had lived here a long time and knew some of the stories that had been around for a long time. And as I was researching things on the BFRO website, I also saw, you know, accounts that intrigued me. One of them was a story about a high school football coach? I think it was high school. Very well-known, Skippy Smith. Skippy Smith. I think he was out fishing, and this was in the 60s, I believe. I'm going to have to look it up. He was fishing and saw one of these creatures and reported what he'd seen, so it made the newspapers, and somehow that came to my attention. So I came to realize that the Legend of Boggy Creek, for example, wasn't an isolated incident necessarily, and started digging into the reports and realized that there were a lot of reports coming from here. But Skippy Smith was one that made the newspapers, so that was what was unique about that, as opposed to just reports sent to the BFRO. They're not going to make the newspaper. So that was one of the earliest that I became aware of. Later on, I met a family that owned some property where there was activity from these creatures. So in order to get some permission to access their property, it was Roger Roberts and Brett Elliott and myself, arranged to meet with the family to just work out some details and what have you. They lived in Honubby. We were early for our appointment. It was a very hot summer day, and so we parked under a big tree, wait until it was a time that we'd agreed upon. And as we were sitting there, this truck pulled up, and out steps this large old guy. And we were expecting that he was going to be a landowner or something, tell us we were trespassing. But he's walking up to us, and he said, "Are you guys Bigfoot hunters?" And needless to say, that shocked us. We weren't wearing Bigfoot shirts or hats or anything like that. No decals. And we kind of stood there in shock a little bit, and we said, "Well, yeah." And he went from looking like he might be a little perturbed at us being there to being, you know, very, very friendly and talking to us. And he kind of sighed at one point. He said, "You know, I grew up in these mountains. I've ridden a horse all through these hills." He was a preacher. He would preach at these little mountain churches. He said, "I've ridden a horse all through these mountains, and I've never seen one." He said, "Just about the time I think there's nothing to it, somebody that I know and trust sees one. And then I start to think again that there could be something to it, but I've never seen one." So I thought that was cool, because he went on to tell us about his life growing up. He said when he was a child, he had been with a nanny, a Choctaw woman that was his nanny. And he described her as elderly, but who knows how old a child really thinks someone is. But anyway, he said that he would always ask this nanny, how do you say bird in Choctaw? And she would tell him, and he asked a lot of those kinds of questions. And one day he said, he asked her, what does kaimichi mean? And she told him, he said, that kaimichi was not one of our words. It's not a Choctaw word. He said that she told him that the elders told her that it was not one of their words, but they had heard from other Indians that lived here when they first came to this part of the country that the word had to do with the upper Kaimichi River area and that it related to giant hairy men that they were afraid of. So you add up the idea of an old man asking an old lady who asked her elders, who said that they were told when they first came out here what that word referred to, then you're going back a long, long ways. So these accounts of giant hairy men are nothing new. They've been around here for a long, long time.
Can you tell the story about Visitation Day?
Oh, Decoration Day.
I mean Decoration Day. Decoration Day.
Decoration Day. Yeah, that's when people from at least this part of the country go out to decorate graves before Veterans Day, I think it is. Memorial Day. I'm sorry, I can't remember which one for sure.
Yeah, I think it's Memorial Day. Memorial Day. My family does that, and it's always in May.
Okay. So our neighbor was going to go out and help out with that, and he asked us if we wanted to go along. So we said, yeah, sure, we'll do that. So on the appointed day, we saw him driving by, and we said, well, there he goes, so let's go. We got to the church where they were going to do this decorating of the cemetery, and there was a bunch of people there, and people like they do, they stand in circles and talk and stuff. So I saw our neighbor standing amongst a group of men, and I went over to stand by him because I didn't know, you know, anybody else that was there. And my neighbor, just shortly after I joined the group, he announced, "Old Al here, he's a Bigfoot man." I was so embarrassed. I thought that those guys were going to laugh at me and snicker or whatever. But amazingly enough, they all just kind of solemnly shook their heads, yeah, yeah. And it was like no big deal to them. They accepted that concept without any problems at all and started talking about it. And I remember one of the stories I thought was pretty amazing. One of the guys said that he was in a little boat fishing in the river, and out of the thick brush going along the bank burst a deer, and it crossed the river. And he said right behind it came this giant hairy ape man chasing after this deer. And again, the crowd of men just kind of shook their heads. Yeah, that's cool. You know, yeah, yeah. Like it's nothing unusual. That was what struck me. Everybody there is kind of just a normal thing for them.
And these were all local men.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm not positive about that because Decoration Day serves around here as kind of almost like a Thanksgiving, when instead of family for Thanksgiving, you have like old friends that get together. And maybe family too, of course, but I had the idea, the sense that a lot of these men had kind of known each other growing up or whatever, had lots of mutual friends, and that's why they were there, not as a family get-together, but as a way of honoring, you know, the people that had gone on before.
Okay, can you tell us a little bit about what you saw at Concho?
Yeah, well, a lot of people think of Concho and they think of the video, the security of video. I never saw that. And the word from the security people there at the casino was that it had been destroyed. Now, I know some people that said they saw it, but I didn't see it. The tribe didn't want that getting out and attracting, who knows, thousands of people to tromp all over the reservation or their tribal lands. I have no reason to doubt that because in all these years since then, you know, it hasn't shown up. Nobody's tried to sell it or whatever. So that's what we were informed. But talk to people that had seen it and talk to people that had seen the creatures. And it was a truly fascinating couple of years or so that I was involved with that investigation. Talking to the people that had seen it, finding evidence myself, going out there unannounced and finding trackways, found hair samples, something across the fence. The video itself, I did investigate that whole scenario. There was a little wash across from the fence that was behind the casino, and it looked like a perfect way of of approaching the road, which the casino was just on the other side of the road. And then when it looked like, you know, it was all clear or whatever, walking across the road, it was just a little two-lane road. And then there was a fence around a big pasture there. And for a corner for the fence, they'd used a tree. And so the barbed wire was tight around this tree, but you could see where one of the wires had been pushed down and the nail that was holding it to the tree had been pulled out. And I'm looking at that and going, holy cow, that would take a lot of weight or strength to push down on a wire and dislodge it that way. And then along the fence, there were tall weeds and you could see the footprints. And the footprints went along the side of the fence, on the opposite side of the fence from the casino. And then you could see where it stepped over the fence on the side, you know, the casino side. And then it went over to the light and the garbage can or the grease trap. People say that all kinds of stuff about it, but I couldn't see that the trap had been, you know, molested in any way. I think it just went up to it briefly and then kept on going to the south. So contacted a local chief, Russell, and he gave us a permit to be on tribal lands, and off we went, trying to see if we could get any more evidence on these things or whatever, and that's really what happened. They invited me once, myself and my family, to go to a Sundance ceremony. They have a tribal land. It's the highest area around there. It's not like a mountain or a hill even, but it's the highest area. And they'll arrange their little tents and structures that they stay in a horseshoe shape that faces east. And so they have, you know, these dances and ceremonies and things. And so took the family, went there with my mom, and it was really cool. These initiates had this gigantic teepee that was in the middle of this horseshoe. And they had, I'm not sure what they did in there, but there was smoke coming out. And these, eventually some of the guys came out wearing, I think it was buffalo hides. They had something around them anyway, and they're walking in a line away, drum beating. They honor warriors, and they would invite men who had served in the military, and they would come up and they would talk about their deeds while they were in the service. And that was really cool. And they would clap for them. Again, they think that to be a warrior is to be, you know, really honored. Well, anyway, they told us that these creatures would come up from behind the ceremonial grounds and search for and eat food that had been left behind after these Sundance ceremonies were over. So I got the thought, well, let's put a camera on the opposite side, that steep north side of the ceremonial grounds, put a camera down there and see what we can get. And there was like a little rivulet. Had some small cottonwood trees and stuff growing all along it. And I went out with Brett Elliott. Matt Moneymaker sent us a camera. And we strapped that camera to one of these trees. And then we left, hoping that, you know, we'd come back in a little while and see what we got. I forget how long a period we waited, but we drove out there to check on the camera. I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit when I want to finish talking about this camera deal. I had strapped this camera to a tree facing north. And it was tight, I mean, tightly bound to this tree. When we got back to look at it, it was on the ground above the slope, above the tree, south of the tree. It had been moved away from the tree about, I don't know, 15, 20 feet, somehow undone from the bindings, the ties and what have you that I had. And that was, how could that, if it was a human, first of all, I don't think any people, you know, go back there very regularly anyway. But somehow that camera had been removed from the tree, relocated uphill from the tree. I was thinking, if this was a person, they would have stolen the camera. The batteries were dead. We didn't have any pictures. But here's the rest of the story, as they say. As we were walking, a guy was with Brett, he's a full-time military guy, and he didn't want to drive his truck into this location behind the ceremonial grounds. So we're walking. After, it was a lot farther than we thought it was going to be. So Brett said, I'm going to go back and get my truck. And I said, okay, I'll go with you. He said, no, it's okay. He said, He was a military guy. They run all the time. So he started off. Well, as we were walking, we had passed earlier, he passed a buck, a really nice buck deer, and it was snorting at us. And this trail wasn't, this road wasn't a straight road. It was, you know, had curves in it and stuff. Well, Brett was going to be gone for a little while, I thought. So my idea was, I'm going to cut across here and see if I can walk up on that buck. So I left the trail and started walking. And then just a little ways off to my right, out busted this huge black bipedal animal. And it just ran away from me. It was so fast, you could hardly believe how fast it was. It was extremely powerful looking, wide shoulders. It ran, kind of stooped over. I didn't see arms swinging. It ran in a stooped over manner and ran to more cover. And I presume it stopped there to see what I was going to do. It was kind of a little ravine kind of a thing. And so there's dense patches of vegetation. Then you might have a little open section, then another dense patch, you know, growing in these lower areas. So that was my first sighting and made me keep working out there.
Do you remember any other stories from the Concho area?
Oh, yeah. We found a handprint. It's pretty crazy. There was a garden. The place where Keith had his office was kind of on the northern side of this little tiny village that was Concho. And behind that was a paved area. They had a whole line of dead cars and stuff. And then behind that, in the soil, they had planted a garden. Well, they reported, I guess someone checked the garden or something, I don't know, but they reported that there were tracks in the soft soil of the garden. And so I wanted to see those. So I went out there, I'm looking, and someone had put their own boot into the track. So you had this track, and then you had the boot in the middle of it. You know, people want to see how big it is compared to their feet, that sort of thing. Well, exactly straight in front of that, on this pavement where they had all these dead cars, there was a mower. And it had a blade cover that was sticking out. And you could just see where something walking along stepped over that blade cover and put its left hand on top of a dead car to balance it or whatever. And then it kept going. And that animal had gone to one of the trailers and was looking at the trailer, and some boy saw it. And so that's a whole nother thing, too. But we saw that handprint, and I was immediately thinking about Grover Krantz's book and his discussion about handprints, and it looked exactly like that to me. But the problem was everything was dirty out there, dusty, and you know, we took pictures of it, but there was no way of dealing with it unless we could get some expert out there from who knows where to Concho in the middle of Oklahoma. So I asked Keith if we could cut the top of the car out and take the handprint with us. And he said, I know the guy that owns the car. And he got back with me. Yeah, no problem. We found out that another research group had learned of the handprint. So Brett had some tools, and he brought the tools out, and we were in a big hurry because we didn't want to be there at the same time that another group got there. Maybe that's paranoid, but that's just the way we were. We were rushed to get it, and we cut out the top of that car and took it to my house and just kind of left it there until Jimmy Chilcutt could look at it. He drove up to Oklahoma City. And the problem was it was a handprint that was put on a dusty surface and then brought away. And so what it lifted was dirt, didn't leave anything behind. And, you know, he has this little whisk thing that, you know, you get some black material. I don't know if you know what the black stuff is that they use to find or look at footprint or handprints. Fingerprints.
It's like a graphite.
It's a refined graphite. Yeah. They use different types of materials now, not just graphite. They have different colored materials now too. But and that whole, it's a whole science unto itself now. Yeah. But probably just graphite.
Okay.
So compared to a man's handprint, what was the size comparison?
I think it was again. It's in a paper I wrote. I wrote a handprint paper where I talked about different handprints that we discovered in Oklahoma. But it's much larger. The thumb was positioned differently. The fingers were wide. They were like an inch wide, which was pretty incredible. Because I did some experiments with that. I had a chalkboard in the classroom where I taught. And I wondered, would having something on your hand indicate really the width of your finger? So I put it in chalk, and then I put it on the chalkboard and measured the width compared to the width of my finger. And it's only about 30%, I think I remember. The thumb and the thenar pad, this big muscle you have at the base of the thumb, they were very different. The thumb was lower, the hand was long.
Was it more like a, like you would think of an ape's hand, or was it more of an opposable thumb like the, humans have?
The thumb, so it was structurally different, but it was still easily identifiable as a handprint.
Mm-hmm.
So Jimmy came up and did his little thing with the little brush and the graphite, and he said, there's just nothing I can do here. And he said, ladies, we had a crowd there because Jimmy Chilcutt was well known at that time, you right. know. And so we had a crowd there. And he said, ladies, let this be a lesson to you. Keep your house clean. If someone breaks into your house and you have a dirty house, I won't be able to find any fingerprints. So anyway, he said, well, you know, what are you going to do with this? And we said, well, you want to take it with you? And he said, you know, there might be something else I can do, you know, back at my lab. We never heard back from him on that. But it was still cool to see it. And we've seen other handprints that were very reminiscent of that. One of them was huge. It was like, I think, 16 inches wide, you know, fingertip to fingertip on opposite sides. It was huge. It was on, there were two of them on this truck. It was a very, the same deal, dusty truck, you know, driving in the mountains of southeast Oklahoma, kicking up dust. And then when we came back after, you know, a few days camping and stuff, we saw these handprints on the truck, distinctive, but again, there's nothing you could do about it except take pictures. So right. I took pictures.
Right.
Do you recall a story about a bus driver?
Yeah.
And parked around back?
Yeah, yeah.
Why don't you tell that story?
Well, I don't know much about it. I think it was Roger Roberts that talked to the guy. Again, there's a casino there, so they would come in sometimes with bus loads of people wanting to gamble. And the bus will, you know, park itself around back, and then the bus driver has, you know, a few hours to wait. And the buses are, you know, they're high. And this bus driver claimed that while he was sitting, I think he was still sitting in his seat, and one of these creatures came up to the bus, you know, to see what it was about. And as I understand the story, it was looking at the guy like face to face. So, I mean, it had to be, I don't know, 7-8 feet tall. And it terrified the bus driver. He just dropped down to the floor of the bus and just stayed there, I guess, for a long time. That's about all I can remember about that.
Can you tell us any more about interactions you've had with Native Americans and either their stories or just connections you've made?
There was one family that, is it okay to say their last name? I don't know.
Yeah, I suppose so.
I guess you can cut it off if you need to. I don't
right.
know. The Redbirds, they were a couple that said that they fed the animals. They would take old produce and stuff out to a certain place along a wood line and dump it out, and then they'd drive away, you know, 100 yards or so, and wait for the animals to show up. And that was kind of something they liked to do. And I told Keith, I said, Keith, you have got to go with the Redbirds so you can see if what they're seeing is real. It never worked out. But the Redbirds, you know, they were honest people. And one day I went out there, like I said, I would go out there unannounced time to time. And sometimes it was pretty brutal because during those years I wore a suit, you know, to teach. So I went out there with this suit, and it was sweltering hot. Well, anyway, I was parked, and the Redbirds just happened to show up. And they said, yeah, we were here last night, and we saw one on the other side of this fence, and it went around over there, and there was a big pond there at the time. So they drove off, and I thought, well, I'm going to go look to see if I can find this. I crossed the fence very carefully so as not to rip my shirt up, and there were prints there. The soil at Concha was very, very fine. I mean, it's absolutely perfect for leaving tracks. There was a trackway, then there was a track, and then I saw it was a trackway. I'm following these tracks, and there was a large rotten tree, and one of the steps was the distance from one step to the next was perfect for this tree. It stepped on the top of this tree and just smashed it, footprint width, smash in this big rotten tree. I followed around, and there was northeast side of this pond was a big stand of cattails. And this thing had, from what I could tell from the smashed cattails and the position of what appeared to be legs and push-offs, it had laid down in this cattail bed to sleep or hide or something. I don't know what. I presumed to sleep. You could see where its heels had pushed off as it was, you know, preparing to stand or as it was getting in position to sleep. That was that was pretty compelling. You know, you can describe it and people go, oh, whatever. But when you're looking at that, you know, it's intriguing to, at the least. And the Redbirds put me onto that.
Who was Keith?
Keith Lumpmouth. He was worked for the tribe. He was considered a chief, kind of managed the buffalo herd and stuff that they had. He was out there all the time. He's the guy that took the pictures at Concho that I wrote about. I gave a presentation about those pictures at the 2003 International Bigfoot Symposium. And very, very compelling to me that the creature was like a male carbon copy of the Patterson-Gimlin creature. Absolutely the same.
There's a kind of a short paper that you wrote that we have on our website about that, about the pictures and the comparison that you did and the analysis. Do you have any thoughts as to why? Do you recall the reaction after you gave that presentation in 2003? Or do you have any kind of thoughts as to why that whole angle didn't get legs, so to speak?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. I was invited to speak at the 2003 International Bigfoot Symposium. John Green was there, John Myncinski, Kathy Strain, Jeff Meldrum. You know, a lot of people that were involved with this kind of research at that time. And I thought it was, you know, here are these two amazing pictures that, as far as I knew, were unprecedented. And to this day, all these 20 years later, no one's taken pictures that begin to compare to them. And I don't know why these people that were so involved with Bigfoot research basically ignored presentation and the pictures, with one exception. John Bindernagel was the one exception. Mm-hmm. On the Sunday after the symposium was over, the organizers took the speakers to the film site, the Patterson-Gimlin film site. And we were in buses, and I was on the row sitting next to John Bindernagel and his wife, and found out they were just wonderful, wonderful people. And John was the only guy that expressed any reaction or response. He liked the paper that I gave. And he said, you need to give that at the Texas Bigfoot Conference, which was coming up in a month or so. He said, talk to Craig Woolheater and have him get you on that list of speakers, was a word for that. Anyway, have him give you, tell him to get you on the speaker list for that conference. So I talked to Craig, and he was cool with the idea, excited about it. And he said there was no place, but they made a spot for me. And I gave the paper again at that conference. But other than that, it was like crickets.
Do you think it might have had anything to do with the fact that it was filmed in Concho? Can you maybe describe the terrain and the sort of the environment, the habitat in and around Concho?
Yeah, Concho is central Oklahoma. It's kind of rolling prairie, I might describe it as. It's not desert. It's not anything like that, like you find in far western Oklahoma, which is very dry, typically. Where there's lower places, you'll have tree growth and bushes and stuff. Because people think of Oklahoma as being, you know, flat as a pancake, but it really is not. It's more rolling. And there's plenty of places. The grass, if it's left unattended, grows quite tall. And any animal, a deer, an elk, whatever, if it just, you know, lays down or squats down, it's not going to be seen by people even nearby. And so that's what it's like. I think these animals, I'm not sure what they eat. I've heard a couple of things from the native people out there, but all they got to do to hide is just squat down.
And that's sort of been our experience, too.
Yeah.
Do you recall who said to you, when looking for these creatures, go in deep, wait a week, they'll come to you?
Yeah, that was someone submitted a report to the BFRO, and, you know, he sounded sincere. I didn't go out to visit the location. I'm not sure he wanted me to. I mean, it's been so many years go by that I don't really recall, you know, the whole situation, but that statement stood out to me from southeast Oklahoma, which is north of here is Cherokee, and this is Choctaw country. Mm-hmm. So I presume that he was Choctaw. And they, again, just like the stories that I told earlier, this is just an accepted thing with the tribal people out here. Mm-hmm. And He said, if you want to find them, that's what he said. It was kind of poetic, you know. Go in deep, wait a week, they will come to you.
Wise.
So that's kind of, yeah, I think in retrospect it turned out that way, because that's kind of the pattern that we followed as a organization, as a research organization, was spending prolonged periods of time and waiting for them to come to us. The majority of sightings that we've had, I would say by far over the last, you know, 20-some years, has been with animals, these wood apes that have approached us, not going out and trying to hunt them down.
Right, right. So earlier today, I heard you told a story about, but you were so tired that you're out and you were laying down in front of the truck on the trail to get some sleep.
Okay, go ahead. I was thinking that spawned another memory for me.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I was with David Wilbanks, and we were basically lost. We were running all over the place. We had a super long weekend, and we were trying to find out a big map and was trying to find some places that I thought looked cool. And we were driving hour for after hour after hour, and I was just totally done. And David, he's like a boundless bunch of energy, but I'm a human being and I was exhausted. I needed some rest. And I told him, David, I gotta get some sleep, man. So we stopped in the middle of this road. It was just a dirt road. And I laid down in the road and went to sleep. He stayed in the truck. And every once in a while, it seemed like every few seconds, he would turn on the lights of the truck, which, again, I was lying on the dirt in the road in front of the truck. He turned on the lights because he was convinced that me being out there would attract an ape to, you know, he's going to eat me or I don't know what. But he was convinced that an ape could be attracted to me being out there. So he pulled a light switch and lighted up. But as far as I can remember, no ape showed up.
Yeah, I wonder what the follow-on plan, if the ape was there, then what happens?
I think he was going to collect it. So anyway, got a few hours sleep, and then we continued. And we ended up in Honubi, and we went into this little store that was there, and back had a little grill. We ate something. I don't know what we ate. Well, this guy came in, and David, I mean, he's this extreme extrovert, and didn't take long for this guy to find out that we were, you know, interested in Bigfoot stuff. We got to visiting with him, and, you know, he's a very friendly guy. Turned out that he was a retired Forest Service supervisor, and out at his place, he had a sawmill, and he made cabins, beautiful cabins. His name was Harold. I was showing him the map, and I was saying, you know, do you know how to get here or there? And he said, you know, there's been so many changes since this map was made. He said, they've been putting in new forest or logging roads and other roads closed and stuff. And so I finally asked him, where would you go? So he told us. He said, but you can't get there from here. He said, you have to have somebody guide you in there. So he told me the name of a guy that could possibly do that. And he was cool, and he said, yeah, I'll take you there. So that's how we find this area that ended up being referred to as Area X.
Can you tell us about the trackway that you and David found?
Yeah, as we were coming out, that whole weekend, as we were driving around, lost or not, wherever we saw a pond that looked like it had, you know, maybe moist soil around the edges of it or wet standing water along the side of the road, wherever we saw that might be a possibility of seeing some tracks, we stop and check it out. So as we were coming out of this area where Harold had recommended, there was another, you know, big muddy area, and it hadn't rained for a long time, so it was dry. And I saw a peculiar little patch of leaves, most of it, of the dried mud patch was smooth, but this was like a little indentation with leaves in it. It just attracted my attention. I pulled out all the leaves, and whoa, right there was a track. And I was fixated on it, just like when I was in Washington. I didn't think to look for more tracks to see if there was a trackway. I was just looking at that one track in Washington, and the same thing here. I was just kind of stunned, you know, whoa, that's a perfectly formed track. And then Randall was the one that found that it was actually a trackway and picked the leaves out of those. And there was one spot where it's the left foot. It was kind of a two-lane two-track, what do you call it, a trackway anyway, two-track road, and there was like a hump in the middle, and you could see. She said, "Look at this. You can see where the big toenail, kind of chattered down the side of this hump in the middle of this two-track, and it was really something else." So I told the organization about it, and I wanted to go back out there to cast those tracks. But by some kind of crazy miracle, that was the same time that the Concho situation became public. And I told Matt Moneymaker, I said, "Man, I want to go out there to cast those tracks." And he said, no, we have to focus on Concho. We have to focus on Concho. And at that time, you know, I was part of this organization. Matt was the leader, you know, it just kind of took his lead on stuff. That's just the way it was. So I never made it back out there to cast those tracks. They would have been awesome. But Concho was awesome, too.
Do you would you mind telling the story about Area Y, the big thicket?
No.
With the, would you call it a growling incident or huffing? I don't even know how you describe the... Daryl, of course, Daryl Collier can do the... He can mimic the sound quite well, but
well, he did.
You were involved in that.
Oh, yeah. We went out to the big thicket several times, sometimes with permits from the Forest Service. And the last time we went out, the permit had been revoked, and we had to go out to retrieve our cameras. But we went out there several times, and it's a nasty, nasty place. We were wading through water that was sometimes hip deep, and it was sweltering hot. Paul, you went out there one time, and it was an hour or so after we had left and had started, and we were out in the middle of nothingness. And we had radio contact with you, though. And time went by, and we couldn't get together. And finally, I told Daryl, I said, "Daryl, go find Paul." So off he went. And I don't know how he got together with you, but after another hour or so, in you came. And, man, I could see you were in rough, rough condition. And we had gone out previously and stashed water bottles and stuff. And I said, "Drink this. Now drink this." And we continued with our mission, which was to check cameras or put out cameras. I don't remember which that time. But, yeah, it was one of our first trips out there. We had responses to blasting out, sound blasting, we called it the Ohio Howl. We'd get responses to that. It was a great area. And one time we went, was it a camera checking expedition?
I think you were filming out there with...
Oh, yeah, that's right. That was a film crew from one of those channels. And that's a whole nother story. I was sleeping in the same tent with Daryl because my tent, somehow, the poles weren't with my tent. So Daryl had a cot, and it was his little tent, but he had his cot pushed up against the side of his tent, and I was sleeping on the ground. And just behind us was a narrow little space, 2 to 3 feet wide, where then the vegetation took up. Because we were at the end of a road that had a turnaround at the end. And we had our tents pitched at the outside edges of this turnaround. During the middle of the night, I was awakened. It was very confusing. I'm going, "What is going on here?" Because I couldn't move. I heard this. What woke me up was this horrendous growling, roaring sound. And it just continued. But I couldn't move. And then I figured out something's on top of me. Daryl had got somehow knocked out of his cot, was lying on top of me. And he started hitting him. Daryl, wake up. I said, "Something's got Speck." Speck was the dog that we had with us. It was the great, intelligent dog. We could write a book about Speck. But finally Daryl woke up. We got up, and the sound was just like loud and continuous, and it was just on the other side of this little fringe of vegetation that I mentioned. And you could make out Speck growling, and this large, huge sounding animal just roaring and growling, and the sound just continued. And I said to Daryl, "Man, doesn't sound like he's breathing," because it was just continuous noise. We're yelling for Mike. Mike was in his teepee next to us, former Army Ranger.
Mike Street,
man, what a specimen that guy was. He looked like he could go right back to jumping out of helicopters and stuff, man. He stayed fit.
Yes.
And Speck was his dog. So anyway, finally the roaring and growling, we were yelling for Mike because he slept with his boots on, literally, because he wanted to be ready to go if he needed to go. We couldn't wake him up. We'd been there for days. You don't know how it is, you know.
Yeah, when you're tired.
Oh, you get exhausted, totally exhausted after you're out doing super difficult stuff for days and getting very little sleep because you're sound blasting at night and Street wouldn't wake up. But finally the roaring, growling sound stopped. You know, we're so exhausted, what do you do? And it's gone. And so we went back to sleep. Well, all of a sudden something woke me up. I say all of a sudden, it might have been 2 hours later. Something woke me up, something alive, thumped me hard in the side. Again, we were in this small tent, so I was right up against the side. Daryl was right up against the backside with his cot, and it scared me. Something hit against me. I could tell that it was a living thing of some sort. And my initial thought literally was, is this something kicking me through the wall of the tent or what? But I heard kind of a sigh, and then I realized it was Speck. Speck couldn't get back into the tent with Mike, and so she settled right up, cuddled right up against mm-hmm. me as close as she could get. Anyway, yeah, we had lots of adventures out there. That's definitely ape country, but it is so, so terrible, miserable.
Wretched.
It's totally inhospitable.
Yes.
Amazing. The man's amazing. Alton is on par with Leroy Fish, with Dr. Bendernagel. He's one of the greats, y'all. And his contributions, not only to the NAWAC, but to the field of Bigfoot research is, to me, it's stellar. He's been an inspiration to me. I've been doing this now for 18 years, and he's been such an inspiration. If you ever get a chance to meet the great Alton Higgins, please don't hesitate to introduce yourself or try to talk to the guy. He's also very kind, very nice, just one of the most decent human beings I've ever known. But yeah, it's good stuff, isn't it?
Yeah,
Jimmy?
He actually might be the nicest person I know. That no exaggeration. And his wife, Anita.
Yeah, just they're just wonderful people. They really are.
The best people. The good news is, as we're only halfway through talking to him. So we've got a whole other episode. Tune in next time. And don't forget to check us out at woodape.org and read some of the papers we've got there. Read the Ouachita Monograph paper. Read the Tag 7 paper.
There's also it's kind of buried. I have to see about maybe putting it a little more to the forefront on the website. But there's a short paper that Alton wrote about a photograph, actually a pair of photographs that came from Concho. That he received from Keith Lumpmouth that shows a wood ape. I mean, it looks like a by God wood ape. And Alton did a comparison to the Patterson-Gimlin figure, and it's a pretty interesting little paper. So I advise everyone to check that out. We'll try to provide a link on the...
In the show notes to the show, right?
Yeah, show notes.
I knew what you were trying to say.
Yeah, I know.
We're not professional hosts. You're an archaeologist, anthropologist, and I'm a geologist.
Right. Wow. I just play a Bigfoot guy on TV.
Right. So. You get us in front of the mic and we can't talk at all. But the two of us, if you get us together, we won't shut up for 48 hours straight.
That's for sure. Yeah. Some might say, take me out. Just forget it. Scratch that, Jimmy. Okay.
Okay. Well, we appreciate it, folks. Thanks for listening. Catch us next time on Apes Among Us.
See y'all.